All right. Welcome back to the Life Without Limits podcast. I'm your host, Yogi Roth. And I want to start off saying thank you for all of the love, social media-wise, sharing this bad boy, rating, reviewing it. All of it helps. It keeps this thing moving, and it allows this podcast to keep growing and hopefully exploring the idea of what it means to be human. And I think right now, to be human, it means to get fired up because college football is here. That is right. We got Cal, we got Hawaii playing this weekend in Sydney, Australia. Are you kidding me? Sold out. It's going to be off the hook. And if you've ever been to Sydney, you'll understand why. And I bet that their tailgate will rival a lot of tailgates here in the U.S. because they know how to get down there. I used to live in Australia, actually. Was a member of the Gold Coast Stingrays, and a gifted football team. Our center was 18, our quarterback was 40, and it was how I transitioned out of playing at Pitt. So excited for that. And the week after, of course, college football is on. I can't wait to broadcast this fall. I got new partners in Ted Robinson and Cindy Brunson, and we start off in Autzen as the Oregon Ducks host UC Davis. So that's fun. And why do I talk about college football? Because we are ramping in this podcast. I want to stay thematic to what's going on in the world and also what's going on with my vibe. And for when we look at the last month, we had Dr. Michael Gervais, arguably the top high-performance psychologist on the planet, also with the Seattle Seahawks, multiple medalists in the Olympic Games in Rio that just concluded. And then we had Phil Steele, whose magazine a lot of you have read, and his process around creating the best, most informative college football magazine. And then we had Mike Yam. We took you inside the Pac-12 network on the road. We were actually literally right outside of Autzen Stadium on the campus of the Oregon Ducks, and you learned about what allows him to compete, how he views competing, and of course his goals and our goals at the Pac-12 network. So I thought the feedback around that was really cool as we kind of took you on the road a little bit. This one, I'm jacked about. And I think if you believe in the ocean, if you believe in energy, if you believe in anything along those lines, you're going to dig Ariel Joseph Towne. I wanted to stay with the vibe around college football. And I think when you enter a stadium, you can feel energy. You can feel teams. You can feel a freshman. You can feel a new quarterback. You can feel when things get tight late in the game. And Ariel Joseph Towne is one of the world's leading feng shui gurus, you know, the study of energy. He's been on Dr. Oz, all the A-listers in Hollywood. He's been around a lot of great, gifted people teaching the art of feng shui. He also is a working actor when he goes by Joe. So he's got two names, two careers. I thought it was just a really interesting conversation. And we do two podcasts, obviously, right? Part one is about his life, his path. Part two is after he feng shuis my apartment. So I think you're going to want to listen. I think you'll get a lot out of it, actually, for your own living space, also for your own space in life. And if you believe in energy, which I do, especially as we're gearing up to be in some of the most energetic stadiums in the country, I think you're going to dig Ariel Joseph Towne. So I don't want to waste any more time. Let's get right to it. Get your notepad out, because this one will get you thinking, no doubt, as we bring in not only the world's top feng shui guru, but also an actor that you probably know from some TV shows. Here's Joe. I'm fired up because it is going to be an experience, this podcast. So much so that there might be multiple episodes that come out of this podcast. And you're going to get introduced to somebody who, at least on the surface, lives multiple lives. In fact, he has multiple names. He has multiple Facebook pages. He has multiple websites. And he's an incredible friend. So let's welcome in Ariel Joseph Towne to the show. Welcome, man.
Thanks, brother.
Got it. So explain your name. We got to go there right after that. Because I could call you, depending on the topic, either name.
Yeah, it's true. Well, as my birth name was Ariel. And it came with two names that I no longer use. My middle name, which was up for some debate with my family about whether or not it was actually a pressure situation from the hospital. Like, you have to decide right this second what it is. But my dad's side of the family is Jewish. My mom's Italian Catholic. So I think there was a little bit of honoring my grandfather, Aaron, with Ariel. And then Jonas was my middle name given to me at birth for my grandfather, Joseph. Joseph's seemed to be permeating my life. My uncle's middle name is Joseph. My older half brother's middle name is Joseph. And my stepdad came into my life when I was a year and a half old. His name was Joe too. So I wanted to be little Joe. So at 5 years old, I asked to change my name, and I had it changed in school. And so I had these two lives. Like you said, I had Ariel from like the people I grew up with, and then Joe all the way through college, graduated as Joe Towne. And then I finally merged them together and changed my name legally in 2001.
So anyway, I had to ask that off the bat, just because I think people are going to wonder.
Right.
But I think it's important to state how we met, where we met, what your envision was that, or what your vision of that was, and your memory of that is, and then I'll share mine, just to kind of level set where we are today.
Yeah, I think we're talking Santa Monica. We're talking Wilshire Boulevard. We're talking a USC game. It's Arizona or Arizona State.
Arizona.
Came down to the final field goal, if I remember correctly. A missed field goal.
By the Wildcats.
Yeah, yeah. So it was during the Lane Kiffin era. It was pre-Sark. I think it was the last season of Kiffin.
Yeah.
And we were there with some mutual friends. I was there with my wife. We were there with Keith and his wife. And I think originally we had scheduled a double date.
Yeah, I crashed that.
They changed it. He changed it. He was like, hey, how about we have a second makeup double date with the wives, but can we just watch the game on Saturday?
Yeah, yes.
And my wife was game and she was excited. And then we'd heard about you, you know, Keith, the first time we had a conversation mentioned your name and I was like, who's this Yogi? Mm-hmm. And, then it was a awesome, you know, for us to connect there. And I think we hopped over to a cafe like a week or two later and lit it up talking about football and the Alchemist and everything.
Well, yeah, so my memory is exactly the same in terms of the night. But okay. What I remember Keith, who was a mutual friend of ours, what he would tell me about you is that, you know, you had this duality to you of, like, you had this great energy as a feng shui master, you know, a guy that totally understands energy in that space, and clearly I'm into that. But you also are an actor, a performer. And I'd always be bugging Keith about that. I've always leaned into the performance-based industry, specifically in Hollywood. And
nice.
I was so stoked on it. Fast forward through a bunch of chai lattes and a bunch of great conversations.
Yeah.
You are the nudge to me to create this podcast.
What?
Yes. I mean, you can remember I didn't know what name to call it.
Yes, I remember that.
I need to meet with you to talk about the name. And so before we even dive into your story, I need to thank you because without that conversation, this doesn't even exist, bro.
Well, I thoroughly appreciate it if I had the remotest, you know, sort of help along the way, but it's so awesome to be here and to see you doing this. You're killing it.
Well, we're trying. Okay, yeah. So speaking of killing it, you know, as you're listening to this podcast, because we all like to multitask, and you Google Joe Town, you're going to see your name pops up on a variety of different shows, from The Practice way back in the day to Law and Order, because that's just epic. And if anybody saw the Tonys, it was hilarious when they just ripped through everyone that has been on Law and Order, because there's so many seasons, so you're on that list.
Yeah.
To movies, to Killzone on the digital series that we've all seen, Friends in Therapy. Really successful actor, and I want to dive back into how you began to perform, because you're a jock at heart in terms of you love sports, you love that mentality, and you're a guy that his life has been built around the art of performance, and there's a bunch of different areas to that which we'll unpack, but I'd love to know how that began and when you leaned into that.
Yeah, so there's two like early stories that I can recall. The first one that lore has it is that at 2.5, I was obsessed with two movies, Wizard of Oz and Star Wars. And I'd watch them every time we went over to a friend's house, they'd project it for me and I'd get lost in this world. And apparently the first time I saw The Wizard of Oz, I ran up to the screen, I tapped it and I said, I want to get in, mommy. How do I get in?
No way.
And so I like wanted to be in that world with the Munchkins and with Dorothy and the whole jazz. And I don't know. I heard a rumor a little bit later that I jumped off of like a Chinese futon upstate New York and everyone clapped for me. And so I just kept doing it. And they like were very sweet and they kept clapping. And I think I nearly got addicted to the idea of entertaining people. But it wasn't really until high school that I discovered acting, or rediscovered acting, I should say. And I really do feel like it saved my life. Like that's a whole other sort of part of the journey.
But I want to talk about being in high school and saying yes to acting. Mm. And what was that like in your community? And from experience, like the community I grew up in, I grew up acting. My brother was an actor, my sister. Mm. But acting was always seen as like, oh, that's the actors. Like that's the theater group. Mm-hmm. With that one teacher who just kind of volunteers to do that. Wondering what it was like in your community. Because I guess what I'm saying is that it was never fully like, yo, come hang out. Acting is cool. Whereas
right.
Now,
yeah,
it's
totally.
Like, oh my God, I would love to go act.
Yeah.
I think as we've gotten older. What was that, your experience like?
Yeah, well, I mean, my personal path to it was that the summer before I got into high school, there was like the summer stock plays. And my mom was very encouraging. She's like, you should try out for the play. And I was like, and I backed down from it. I was too scared. Like, middle school had been really rough on me and I just didn't feel like a yes. And I went into high school and we had a new teacher. He was my English teacher, but he was running the theater program. His name is Jordan Hornstein. And he had us read monologues out loud. And I think I read a Shakespearean sonnet in class. And he called me up after class. And I didn't know if I was in trouble or what. And he's like, you were really quite good. You should come down and check out what we're doing in the theater. And I did. And within 2 weeks, I was the assistant director. And I was the offstage voice. It was the miracle worker. And I was the 7-year-old dead brother of Annie Sullivan, Jimmy Sullivan. And I was doing my first voiceover job backstage. And we fortunately had a theater program that was funded. Like, the arts were funded where I grew up at that time. Gotcha. So they did 7 plays a year, if you include the winter musical, the middle school plays, and the summer stock plays. So I had the opportunity to do 28 plays before I graduated. Wow. And so halfway into that journey, I heard about this amazing camp upstate New York. And it was in Loch Sheldrake, and it was called Stage Door Manor. And so I went for a summer, and I came back and had decided I'm definitely going to school for this. I feel like I answered how I got into it, but I didn't answer the second part to your question, which is, how was it perceived? We had cliques, you know, we had different sections of the school. You know, you had kids that were more into music. You had kids that were definitely more athletic. You definitely had some people that were not really in either group, maybe a little more outsider. And then there were, you know, the theater geeks, and they weren't really put down upon, but they were mostly ignored. And then there was like this one time a year that when we had a play, we'd put it on in front of the whole school. Like, they'd be forced to sit in the auditorium and watch a preview of whatever show we were doing. And that was really the only time we felt noticed. And the first time that I got that entire auditorium to laugh, I was like, oh my God, this is so addicting. Like, this is an amazing thing. And it came off of a flubbed thing that was improvised.
Wow. So it's like when you were a kid and you were jumping off of that same,
yeah,
whatever.
Totally.
That futon.
Yeah. And I finally felt good at something. Like, I finally felt like, I think I can do this. Because I had 2 other professions that, after I pointed to the screen and said, I want to get in, when I was like 6 to 7, I think I wanted to be an accountant because I loved Monopoly and I was quite good at numbers. And that didn't live very long because then I realized what accountants actually did. But I wanted to be a professional baseball player. Like, I fell in love with the New York Yankees. Dave Winfield was my favorite ball player. I asked my dad, where should I go to college? He's like, go to ASU, become a ball player. And I went to baseball camp for 3 years in Trenton, New Jersey. And I listened on my little handheld radio to all the Yankee games. And I was obsessed. I'd play stickball, whenever. And I just, when I started growing, I think I went through a growth spurt. And I think my eyes didn't catch up. And I became super afraid of the high inside fastball. Mm. And that really changed my relationship to the game. Like, I, for a while, thought I could do it. And then I was like, I can't do this thing. My body's not doing the thing that I want it to do.
Do you remember the time when, or the moment when it was like, I don't know if I can play anymore?
Yeah. Yeah. It was after a couple of disappointing at bats. And the particular feeling was, I didn't see the ball clearly until it was right here. And it was too late for me to react. And now that I've studied a little bit of sports science, like, that window's very narrow.
Yeah.
But we're not talking about 100-mile-an-hour fastballs, but we're still talking fast enough that it made a difference. And about 6 months later, I ended up realizing I needed glasses, which would have made a huge difference if that had been caught.
Wow. But did you have to explain that to your dad, who you said years earlier, where should I go to school? And he said ASU. And you got a mom who's pushing theater. Not pushing, but supporting theater.
Yeah. No, I think it fell off. I think it fell off sometime around middle school before I actually got into high school. And then I actually went through a period of time in high school where, even though I had my stepdad, who was sort of took his name, and my biological dad and I took a few years break from communicating. And so I think my discovery of wanting to be an actor happened during that time. So we never actually had that direct conversation.
Curious about, you know, we'll move on in a minute, but I want to stay in this era for you.
Yeah.
As an actor, your job is to act, right? You're reading somebody else's lines that they put on a piece of paper. Hmm. For somebody who's going through a transition of, let's just say, sport click, sport theater click, theater click.
Yeah.
What was that like for you? Because you basically were able to maybe get lost in other people's words, where you were maybe lost in your own reality. And I'm not projecting that upon you, but I'm curious, because that's what I'm hearing to a degree.
Yeah. Becoming an actor allowed me 2 things that were almost simultaneous. One is I could disappear into a role, and it helped me not feel invisible. Mm. I really went through a period there where I wanted to be invisible and I was successful. And then all of a sudden it didn't feel so great. And, you know, being a teenager is confusing enough as it is. But the reason I say that acting saved my life is I was a stress case, man. I was like, it was really hard. I was being raised by a single mom. She was going through her battles with addiction and was in 12-step programs. I joke that I went to more bars before I was 17 than my friends have gone to since they've turned of age. I was the under 13 dart champion of Long Island. My entire family were dart champions during their drinking stages. And so it was just really rough and I had all these feelings inside. I didn't know what to do with them. And characters allowed me to experience the feeling, but be enough removed from it that I could process it and I could experience other perspectives. And it just gave me insight. It helped me channel some of my anxiety. And I never went on stage without a trip to the bathroom first. I mean, I would sit, I jokingly say that I discovered God on the toilet, right? Because I was in so much pain before every performance. I would be in a stall. And it happened to be during a time that I was taking some of those habits that formed from going with my mom to those meetings and drinking a lot of coffee. So I'm sure that that had a lot to do with it, that coupled with nerves, but I was having coffee every day. And so before a show, I'd be in the stall and be like, please, if something's out there, please take my pain away. And it disappeared every time. And it's amazing. The anxiety didn't necessarily go away. The pain went away. And as soon as I stepped on stage, anxiety was gone. It was like all that energy that I was judging was there to help me, but I misinterpreted it. And so I was there thinking, oh God, you're nervous and this is a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And it's taken me a long time to understand the science that that's actually a wonderful sign and I can interpret it differently.
Why do you think, because we both are around high performers a lot. You're also an acting coach, yeah. Successful actor, successful performer. I'm around a lot of jocks and athletes. And for whatever reason, I feel like a lot of the ones that thrive have similar paths of like, I was lost. It was hard. Basketball and the courts in Dalton, Pennsylvania, I'd say saved my life. Wow. And you just said that acting and theater saved yours.
Yeah.
What do you think that is? Because we can go down a laundry list of Hall of Famers, and they can say the same thing. It was the football field. It was the baseball diamond. For you, it was the stage. For other actors, they've said the same thing. Hmm. What do you think that is? Because there's a commonality there of high performers.
Yeah. The only thing that I can really imagine it is finding and living a passion. Hmm. It was something that was so clear when I was doing it that more of this, please. It brought about the best qualities in me. It filled me up. It was something that I was curious about. I was devouring scripts. And I went through a period of time. I remember early on when my parents were still together, my stepdad and my mom, that I was an avid reader. Like there was an MS Readathon that I read 230 books in 1 month. Now, some of them were tiny and some of them were like a couple hundred pages. But I was an avid reader and I had maybe an advanced reading level if I can remember correctly. But then I went through a period where I didn't read. And the only time I read is when I was forced to in school, and I wasn't into the books that they were asking me to read. And so, embarrassingly enough, the things that got me back to reading were reading Archie comics and the Babysitter's Club books. Those were the two things that took my mind off stuff. And what took the place of those two crazy things in junior high school were plays. So I'd read plays and I started researching for characters. Like I remember my senior year, we did Look Homeward, Angel, this play. And there was a book that was like 400 pages. And because I knew I was going to take on this role, I read the entire book in the off season, like in the summer, and I was preparing. And that was one of the most deeply fulfilling roles I ever did on the high school stage. So, yeah.
Okay. So you go to college, you're going to act, and you have this amazing path of kind of bi-coastal, New York, LA, New York, LA. What's it like to be a young actor now? I mean, you've been in the game for a while now.
Yeah.
When you look back on that time, because there's a lot of young actors, aspiring actors, actors that are in the throes of it right now, just getting going, and there's heartache. I mean, look, every one of us think we're going to go to New York, we're going to go to LA, and like, you get to see me, and when you do, look out. And sometimes that happens. Like sometimes we book stuff. We get lucky, but for you, you had some really good luck, and you had some times where it was realistic to what happens in every profession, but specifically acting. What was that like for you?
Yeah, you know, I've heard a story similar to mine in that when I first moved out here, I didn't know it was supposed to be hard. So I just booked jobs. And then I started talking to people and they started telling me how hard it was and how hard it was supposed to be. And I really started to believe them. So when I came to school out at USC, originally I didn't actually know where SC was. I visited an uncle in Malibu and I visited three schools, USC, UCLA, and Occidental. And so when the summer before I was going out to school out here, I was talking to some friends and talking to my summer stock theater director. And he's like, "So you're going to the hood, huh?" I was like, "What?" He goes, "You're going to school in Watts?" And I was like, "What's..." He's like, "You're going where the riot started?" I'm like, "What riots?" He goes, "You don't pay attention to the news?" I'm like, "No." I purposely had tried to segue away from the news for another reason. Anyway, so I get to SC. I was like, "Yeah, it's 10 minutes from the beach, right?" Because I remember driving through the tunnel and getting dropped off on campus. Anyway, I went to school for theater and I thought film. And I ended up just being surrounded by filmmakers. So I ended up hitting a roadblock kind of early on. And they said, "Yeah, upperclassmen are probably going to get the parts. Underclassmen, you might get a tiny role. You might not get cast." And I was like, "That's not fair." Right. And then second thing I did is like, "I wonder what the film school's doing." So I took a picture and resume that I had. I dropped it off at the film school in this little tiny one room office. Started getting phone calls. "Hey, you want to do my short film?" So I did like 30 student films over the next couple of years. And I learned about blocking. I learned what not to do when you're on a set. Like I looked what was too much. I did some terrible work, but I learned a ton. And I think that really showed me a couple of different things, but I always felt like I would work. Like I just had this opinion in high school that if you did good work, you would work. Now I didn't get roles I wanted, but I got other roles in those productions. And I went home and I cried and I was upset in high school and, you know, disappointed. But other times I just shrugged it off and it was easy. And I think what you're talking about is the cumulative effect of rejection. And as an artist, we go through a tremendous amount of it. And I'm also a writer. And when I turn in a script and it gets rejected, it feels a little less personal. But when it's me that's being rejected, that's sometimes where it's really challenging. Because then I identify with it and I'm like, am I a failure? Am I not enough? So I've wrestled a lot with that, had many dark nights of the soul, and I completely understand now that I'm on the coaching side and teaching side how often that happens to artists. And, you know, my heart goes out to all of them because, you know, the courage to continue when the signs or when the results aren't what you want them to be, I think is so important in terms of long-term grit, but those moments are not fun. It's like where the muscles are growing, you know?
Yeah, but that's interesting because I sat in on one of your acting classes to divulge to our listeners. Yeah. And it was really cool because, one, like, I get to play in the acting space. I get to, I believe as a broadcaster, my job is to listen like my life depends on it, which is, you know, a major lesson as an actor and a performer. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious how you look at the audition process now, because mm-hmm. I think that it's fun in terms of not the rejection, because you're not outcome-based. You're so process-based. How did that shift for you? Because you had this great phrase that I wrote down. I went through my notes from our class, and you said, "Be a gracious host when you walk into the audition room." Now, I don't know the depth in which way you teach that, but I perceived it as when I go into an audition, whether it's for sports or whatever it may be, I'm walking in there saying, "This is like a game." So, and you're welcome to my arena, you know? Or if I'm in your court, like, it's going to be mine.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm going to be gracious about it, and I'm going to tear your head off. And I could care less about what the final score is. Is that accurate about what being a gracious host even means? And have you shifted from, "Oh man, am I not good enough," to "Fuck it, like I'm gonna go in and ball"? And you know what? Like maybe you're not good enough. At least to tell yourself that if you don't get the role.
Yeah, you're asking such great questions. I really love this part of the conversation because it's interesting for me to think back that I've evolved on a perspective. Like when I was a young actor, I really talk about this all the time to my students. I wish I had a time machine so I could go back and tell myself a handful of things. And, you know, I think that the first step in reframing the audition experience, I owe a lot to, I've had a lot of amazing teachers. My most recent teacher that is, like a family member to me and like a dear friend and like a surrogate mom, I danced with her at my wedding, is a woman named Warner Laughlin. And Warner is responsible for, I call it like bringing my confidence back to life, re-stimulating my desire to be an actor, showing me a creative process that didn't put me in my head, but really allowed me freedom to play. And I also met my wife at the studio and some of my best friends there. So I owe her a ton. And she really communicates some amazing stories with some of her sort of A-list clients and like their mindset. So I've been able to borrow from that. And that is to treat the opportunity as, what if you already have the job? Like, what if you have the job and you get to go up and show up and this is your job today, is you're going to share with someone, hey, this is my take on the character. And this might be something you get to do for a few months if it's a film, or 7+ years if it's a TV show. But to figure out, if I'm going to do this job, if I'm going to say yes to it, how am I going to say yes to it? What do I want to do? And then to have this quiet confidence about it, you know, just being able to come in and say, look, this is me and I'll work with you. If you want to take it in a new direction, great. But I think sometimes I came in like a sponge early on, like, hey, what do you want?
Right.
And sometimes I came in with this idea and I had an idea in mind and I'd fall into a million traps. There were traps for me, mental traps. There were traps for me in the waiting room, traps for me the morning of, traps for me the night before. If I had family in town and didn't go to work on my sides, I fell in a lot of traps. So the gracious host is an outgrowth of, who do I want to be and how do I want to feel when I'm on set? Do I want to be someone who's so consumed with my own neuroses about lines? Or do I want to say hi to somebody and know that person's name, whether they're the key grip or whether they're the director or producer? And those crystallizations have only come in the last year and a half since listening to podcasts like yours, podcasts like Mike's. Like, understanding sport and understanding high performance has given me the language to understand what I was coming to understand for so many years, and understand like what, I don't know, what was no longer working for me. And I needed an infusion of new energy in it. It's something that I'm so passionate about now.
That's cool. And the podcast he's referring to is Finding Mastery. Check it out. Dr. Michael Gervais, good friend.
Yeah.
He's been on the podcast as well. So I want to stay there, though.
Great.
Because there's one thing to talk about it, right?
Yeah.
We can talk about the mindset we want when we walk into an audition. Now, and for all of you that aren't actors, this is walking into a pitch. This is walking into an interview. This is walking into a date, right? This is walking into meeting a family for the first time. I mean, these are all those types of moments. And you train yourself basically to walk in and own it, right?
Mm-hmm. If we're just part one.
Yeah, part one, kind of own it. We talk about that.
Yeah.
But then we have to train it, right? And then we get to go test it, right, at the same time. And you can flip those two depending upon your ideology. But how do you do that? And how have you done that? Because, yeah, I sat in your acting class. Everybody walks out like, I'm going to slay the audition tomorrow. And then you get there. And I've been in those auditions where, like, I walk in, I'm like, man, every guy looks like me, and actually they're all way better looking, and oh my god, like, they're gonna do this, and I think I remember him from a commercial I saw, and all of a sudden everything's out the window. 100%. Man.
Yep. And they, you know, that comes from one of my favorite quotes, which is that comparison is the thief of joy. And if you're comparing yourself to the times that it went well, if you're comparing yourself to that actor from the commercial, if you're comparing yourself to the way you think it should be, I love in Phil Jackson's book, Sacred Hoops, he has this quote and says, the quarter of an inch difference between heaven and hell in our experience is the difference between accepting things the way they are versus the way we'd like them to be. And I can't stop quoting that, because that quarter of an inch difference is within our control. But the way it plays out is literally the difference between heaven and hell in our experience. And so I just keep reminding people, what's your job? Like, what? Stay in your lane. Tend to your garden. Like, if you're coming into an audition situation and your focus is on booking the job, you're already lost.
Right.
It's not up to you. If it was up to you, you'd probably give yourself the job every time. And so we have these different terms like booking the job or booking the room. Booking the room is like a silver medal at the Olympics. It's wonderful. You get great feedback. Sometimes they write you a role. Sometimes they just remember you and call you in again. Sometimes your agent or manager just gets great feedback. But again, if you're seeking confirmation from an outside source, I think you're barking up the wrong tree. So the only time I'm ever fully okay with not getting a job is if I walk out and say, I did everything I wanted to do. So my goal is to prep myself and to remind myself to do everything I want to do, which includes a certain way of training, a certain way of warming up, and a certain kind of presence and following my impulses, that when that happens, if I don't get it, there's nothing else I could have done.
You know, it's interesting, and I relate a lot to athletics just because of my background, but as an athlete, your sole focus is to train for your sport, right? If you're in high school, okay, you got school, but like you're obsessed with football or sure. whatever, you can do it. When you're in college, you have the time, the demand on is much greater. Mm-hmm. When you get to the league, like you're getting paid to literally do that. In acting, especially when you dive in, even though you're on the roster, quote unquote, like yeah. you got to have a job. You got to have other stuff going. So my point is the time to train isn't as much as it is maybe when it's just your sole focus. Mm-hmm. So how do you tell people, because especially in this town, like it's not easy to live, right? Apartments no. cost money.
Yeah.
I'm sure you deal with this a lot of like, okay, I can go to work when I go to class, but there's a phrase that I know we both love called lonely work, right? Willing to do the boring things longer than others. Not yeah. other people, but other things.
Mm-hmm.
How have you seen that play out for yourself specifically? And then what is your advice to the grander audience?
Well, it's been a bit of a journey now. I mean, I've been a guy who's had a soul-crushing day job. I've been a guy that has done stuff for day jobs that were deeply creatively fulfilling, but not monetarily fulfilling. And I've had periods where I've taken a big running leap at putting some money away and then not working at all so I could just focus on being an actor. And that comes with its own stress too, because then when I watch the numbers dwindling, like that background anxiety puts more pressure on, or has put pressure on auditions. So I think part of why I started searching for something else to do as my day job started around the time of like, well, what do I love to do? I'm not looking for another profession, but in addition to being creative and writing and telling stories, I love helping people. So really that's where becoming a life coach and where feng shui, where they were passions of mine. I found myself doing it anyway. I discovered feng shui because I wanted to have a better acting career, not because I wanted to develop a career being a feng shui consultant. And in fact, for years, my mantra was, I don't want to be known as the feng shui guy. Like that was something I said repeatedly.
Okay. Well, I don't mean to interrupt, but what is the benefit of learning feng shui to acting?
Yeah. So because I was always living with roommates and I was kind of scared to live on my own. And I was a real big believer, I still am a real big believer in conscious manifesting, right? So coming up with an idea of something and going after it. And I did that. I did that kind of successfully. I was living in an apartment situation that was no longer working for me. And I came up with a vision, a checklist, if you will, like, I want it to be in this area. I'd love for there to be a pool. I'd love laundry in the unit. And I don't like air conditioning. I'm not an air conditioning kind of guy. So I'm like, if it had a breeze that came through the apartment, that'd be amazing. Anyway, I put this list together. And all of a sudden, 2 weeks later, I got a phone call from an unexpected person I'd been in class with once. She's like, hey, I heard that you're looking for an apartment. I'm like, who'd you hear that from? She's like, this other guy. I was like, oh, I met him once. Yeah. Anyway, she's like, I bought an apartment. I'm renting out the two rooms downstairs. One of them's yours if you want it. I'm like, well, tell me about the place. She goes, it's in this area. It's got underground parking, a pool, laundry in the unit. The greatest thing is it has a breeze that comes through the apartment. You don't even need air conditioning. I'm like, well, how much is it? And she tells me, and it's more than I wanted to spend. So she's like, just come see it. So I come and see it. I say yes. They paint my room. They build me a closet. I've got my own little like closet, bathroom, bedroom, like wing. And I move in and we're just not on the same page. Like these people are like the first night, they're like, hey, come out, let's have some drinks and celebrate. I'm like, awesome. So like, I really did it up. Cause you know, if you're going to do something, yeah. go big. Right. And so, you know, at the end of that night, I'm hurting. And the next night they're like, hey, let's go out and celebrate. I'm like, we just did that. It's Sunday night. I've got auditions tomorrow. And within 2 weeks, I mean, some crazy stuff went down. I mean, the people were involved in a relationship behind the back of somebody else. I literally had to take the knife out of someone's hand that was trying to take their own life at 5 a.m. with my name being called. And I was like, once we got that person help, I was like, I can't do this. Like, I can't live here. I'm so sorry. And so my biggest challenge was that I felt like I had asked for that situation. So I was here trying to manifest this thing. And I have this woman who I reference in the book who I met about a year after my mom passed away. And she was one of those people that changed my life for the better. And she's the reason I know about feng shui. But when I went to her and said, listen, I don't know what to manifest. Like, I don't know if I want to live by myself or with roommates. I don't know if I live in Santa Monica or in town. She's like, this is so easy. All you need to do is pray for the perfect place for you and everyone else involved. And I was like, pray?
Come on.
God, like I did that when I was on the toilet back in high school. I did not have an active relationship to prayer. Like I prayed for people when they were like, my uncle is sick, and I would say a prayer for them. I prayed, you know, at Grace at dinner, you know, but I didn't have a relationship to that in terms of manifesting. And this idea of the highest good, like the best for all people involved, was a new concept for me at the time. So I did. I walked out of her office. I went for a walk in LA. 45 minutes, people are staring at me as they're driving down major boulevards going, why is this man using his legs? And so I ended up saying thank you in advance for the perfect place for me and everyone else involved. That was what she suggested. Say thank you in advance as if it already happened. Say thank you for the place and see what happens. 45 minutes later, around the corner, I run into an ex-girlfriend. She's putting boxes in the back of her car. I'm like, what are you doing? She goes, I'm moving in with my boyfriend. I'm like, that's great. She goes, hey, if you hear of anyone that needs an apartment, I need someone to take over my lease or I have to keep paying for it. I'm like, where is it? And I was like, is that the place I helped you move into? And she goes, yeah. And I went the next day. I put down an application. I moved in 3 days later. It was the perfect place for me. But now I didn't know if I could afford it. I was living on my own. I was paying utilities. I was like, I need all the help I can get. So I went back to the woman, the chiropractor, nutritionist, sort of guru-y lady that I was seeing, and that she was helping me with like all the mental stuff. And she said, I think it's time for you to call the feng shui master. And this feng shui master was like the feng shui master to the stars in LA. So I called him, didn't hear back. Called him again, didn't hear back. Third time, he says, I just got a cancellation. I guess I'm supposed to meet you on Thursday. So he comes to my house. We sit on my floor 5.5 hours later. And he introduced me to the art and science of feng shui. And I wanted to use it to get more auditions, to get more bookings. I wanted to get it to pay my bills and not stress. I wanted to have better relationships. I wanted to have good health. And feng shui really taps into all these different parts of our life. And so I really set up my entire space thinking about all the different parts of my life at the same time. And so I know I'm jumping a little bit ahead here, but there was something about that's the reason why I wanted to be helped. That's what I wanted to help with feng shui. And the next thing I know, I'm called back for 6 of my next 8 auditions. I book a movie. I start dating someone. I don't think it's necessarily going to be marriage, but then the biggest crazy thing, my favorite story is that, it turns out my parents' divorce, that all my birthday money and holiday money was lost when I was like 7 or 8. And so my uncle emailed me out of the blue after I'd feng shui'd my place. And I didn't know the correlation till later. He's like, I think there's a lost account for you in your name. Like I was looking up your mom and looking up lost funds. And so I call up, and a lot of times it's like $50, like your insurance, we owe you a check. But this one required a signature from my stepdad. So he fills it out. Months go by. He calls me up. He goes, remember that thing that I sent in? I go, yeah. He goes, turns out it's your account from when your mom and I separated. And it's got $23,000 in there. And it's been accruing interest. And so all of a sudden, this money from out of nowhere shows up. And my friends are like, all right, what's going on with you? And I was like, I feng shui'd my apartment. They're like, what? I'm like, I feng shui'd my apartment? I didn't know if they were going to think I joined a cult or like, what happened? And I just kept seeing cause and effect when I did stuff. And so it did help every part of my life. And I've just seen this cause and effect. And even though I didn't want to do that as a profession, I wanted to tell friends about it to help them.
Wow. The book he's referencing is Serene Makeover Inner Edition. It'll be on the blog post. It's a really fun read, to be honest.
Thanks, dude.
Okay, so explain this to me. Because what you just described from the apartment to the first apartment to the second apartment to then getting jobs, to me sounds like law of attraction.
Mm-hmm.
Feng shui, at first, if someone on the street heard it who had a somewhat of an idea, and I've heard that word before, they'd think energy of like a space, like this feels really good, right? You said you feng shui'd your apartment.
Yep.
Where's the connection between the two, and when did you find out the reality? Because you meet the feng shui guy, you have a 5-hour conversation, but you then basically are putting these things out into the quote-unquote universe, and it's coming back amazingly, but I'm trying to find the tie into... Yeah, I want to make sure that, like, I've got, like, glass here, and I've got some crystals here. Like, because that is, I think, the layman's, at least for me, and I'm a layman in feng shui, at least as of right now.
Yeah.
Where's that connection for you?
Well, you know, when most people think about feng shui, they think about, where do I put my stuff?
Right.
And so my initial training was, how do I set up my apartment? Where do I put a couch? Where do I put a bed? What colors do I use? What artwork? Based on this ancient tradition that's been evolving over thousands of years. You know, it didn't start out with people hanging crystals and chimes and, you know, doing a vision board. It came with them observing that when they lived in harmony with nature, their lives were just better. And there are a lot of principles at play there. So I was learning, like, where do I put my stuff? But my feng shui master left me with a lot of inner work to do. He's like, you have to be really clear about your intentions. Because what happens if you say, yeah, I want more money. Who doesn't want more money? And then you walk down the street the next day and you find 20 bucks. Is that what you meant? Mm. Because if your intention is more money and that's all you say and it's general, maybe you're just going to generally start noticing things. But when I was very specific with my intentions, those things were really like mind blowing. And I don't mean specific to the point where I'm looking for a girl. She's this tall. She looks like this. She weighs this. She has this color eyes. Like, it's nothing like that. I had different qualities. I was like, I want someone who makes me laugh. You know, like I want someone to feel like I'm a teammate with. And, you know, so coming up with the inner work was the other part of my life. Like the life is the life coach, like the part where it was like, hey, what are you trying to accomplish? Let me see how I can help you get there. Do you need to make a plan? Do you need confidence? Like, what do we need to figure out? Let's figure it out together. So this was like a merging together of the two worlds, the intentional law of attraction, if you will. That's like, I know, a big catchphrase and buzz phrase. And I think the idea of putting your conscious mind onto something has enough power in and of itself. The idea behind feng shui is that if you just put a plant in the corner, it's really just a plant. But if you start putting it there for a purpose, with an intention, and you imbue it with that intention in your mind's eye, and then you do maybe a little ritual, a little blessing, if you will, maybe just by saying thank you 9 times, or doing something to activate the energy of what you're doing, that combination of body, mind, and spirit, of placing the item, visualizing, and changing the energy, all of a sudden you're surrounded by these items that are like mini cheerleaders that are helping you. And whether or not it's just your mind going, I feel good in the space because I did this ritual, or whether or not those things actually have an energetic power to them, I'm going to leave that up to the mind of the listener. Because some people might just say, oh, you're just using your conscious mind. Okay, cool. So using your conscious mind, that's never a bad thing. And if it's all like the most amazing placebo effect in the history of the world, God bless. But if there's something too that our environment can affect us, and I, you know, you've been someone who's been to a stadium that I'm curious about, Autzen Stadium, right? You tell me, going into a stadium like that, what home field advantage is like. And yeah, you could break it down as sound, right? You could probably say it's the loudest stadium, you know, the 12s up in Seattle, they probably might lay claim to the loudest stadium. Sorry, Arrowhead. But, you know, I feel like in addition to the mechanics and the science, that there might be tens of thousands of people sending vibes towards one specific thing to happen. And I think that must have an impact. The consciousness of multiple people coming together creates an energy. So to me, energy is an outgrowth of thought and emotion. Right. And if you can then leave that energy behind, what they call that in feng shui is residual qi or inheritor's qi. So it's like something happened in a space before and you can almost pick up on it when you go there. So as a traveler, if you've ever been to Pompeii, if you've ever been to the 9/11 memorial, if you've ever been to Scotland or in the gallows where they hung people, there's like a vibe to that place, you know? And like whatever happened there before, you can pick up on. And then there's also positive examples of that, like coming into a house where the family grew and coming to some place where the business expanded, or it's near nature and it's just beautiful. And like you can feel good when you walk in. Or for some people, it's grandma's house, you know? So I call this like the stoplight. You asked about how you feel in a space. So the easiest way that introduce people to feng shui is by their own intuition. When you walk into a space for the first time, is it like a green light? Does it feel like, yes, I want to stay here. I'm curious about this place. It feels good. I feel turned on. I feel awake. I feel inspired. Or do you feel like, get me out? You know, like the horror movies were like, get out. Like some places are red light and you walk in, you're like, I feel gross. I don't want to be here. Something went down. And then there's yellow light. And most people that I know either have as part of their home or their entire house at this point, a feeling of meh, right. My space is neither here nor there. I'm kind of tuned out to it, to be honest. Like I've been there. I know what's on the walls. Like I haven't dealt with that shelf. I never go in that room. We live in a storage society. Like we spend trillions of dollars on storage units. We have too much stuff culturally, at least most Americans do. And so it's fascinating. Then that's why we have to hire people like organizers and feng shui people to come in and have them help you make more space.
What year was this conversation with the feng shui master?
Yeah, so that would have been in 2000.
Okay, so 2000. When are you fully in? Like, are you fully in then? Because your feng shui career is about to get cranked up. And I'm curious, were you prepared for that? And how did that even come about? Because before you know it, if you can take us up to this place, before you know it, you're on Dr. Oz, which at the time is like the most epic show in afternoon television.
Yeah, thanks, man. I did not see it coming.
This wasn't an intention.
No. What happened is, you know, my friends were like, hey, what's going on with you? And then I wanted to help them out a little bit. But to be honest, I have this skeptical brain. I'm from New York. So I'm open, but I'm skeptical. So I'm like, I'll try it. If it works, I'll do more, right? So like the next time my feng shui master comes to my house, he's like, there's no pictures of you up. How come there's no pictures of you up? I'm like, I don't want pictures of me up. He goes, you're telling the world a message that your life is all about other people and it's not about you. You need to put a picture up. I'm like, what kind of picture? He goes, headshot. Put up a headshot in your fame area. I'm like, no, I'm not putting up a headshot in my house. People are going to walk in. There's no way. So we compromised. We found a photograph of me at Joshua Tree taken by my best friend at sunrise on top of a mountain with sun rising behind me. I was like, that I can put up because that's an epic moment in my life. And it happened to serve a feng shui purpose. And then I booked a film. I did this thing, book a film. So then I put up another. So then his like assistant comes with him the next time. She's like, there's no pictures of you up. You need to put up a headshot. I'm like, I'm not putting up. She goes, you're putting up a headshot. So I print a headshot without my name on it. I put it on the fridge facing away so that when people come in, they don't see it, but it's there. I book another project. Then I slide my TV and my black wood console into the career area. My pager goes off. That's how long ago this was. And I get an offer to come in and get signed with a commercial agency. Every time I was doing something, there was cause and effect. So it was putting out my like skeptical mind being like, there's something to this. Pay attention. And then all of a sudden people were like, hey, will you help me with this? Will you help me with this? Will you help me with this? And part of the feng shui tradition is that there needs to be an energy exchange. And so I realized like, I don't mind helping and I'm not doing this as a career, but you know, I really feel like something needs to be exchanged there. And then what happened was kind of epic. So I had this day job and I was really not happy. Like my boss, I felt like was a little bit miserable and like taking it out on me. And like, I would go in and see my buddy Craig and be like, Craig, I remember one day I storm in, I kick a box. I'm like, I have a degree. I can't believe I'm getting paid 10 bucks an hour to drive around. My car's getting scraped up. Oh man. And here I was in Complaint City. And so I go back to Renata, Dr. Renata. And I say, I hate my job. And she goes, well, I think it'd be time for you to find out a way to be grateful for it. I was like, all right, hold up. I understand when you say, yeah. I was like, wait a second. Come on, Joe Pesci. I was like, I understand being grateful when I book a job. So grateful. I can even see being grateful for the sun, the moon, and the stars. But when you tell me to be grateful for something that I hate, I don't know what you mean. She goes, I think that's your work. And I think that if you can find a way to be grateful for this job, A, you won't have to do it for very long, and B, you'll never have to do this kind of job again.
Mr. Miyagi on you.
She went total Miyagi. And so I waxed on, I waxed off. I put sticky notes on my steering wheel. I would like read some kind of like book on my right before bed, on the bench before an audition, like constantly bringing my mind from irritation back to gratefulness, back to positivity, back to reframing my mind and focusing on a different feeling tone inside me. 3 weeks later, I got a phone call from my friend saying, hey, we're getting married in New York. We want you to be the officiant, you know, or can you come out to New York? We want you to be the best man. Sorry. And by the way, we're also getting remarried in France like a few months later for the European relatives. I'm like, well, I don't know about the French one, but I'll be in New York. No problem. 10 more days go by. I get a phone call from my mentor from USC. He's older than dirt. He's in his like late 80s, early 90s, John Blankenship. Everybody who went to USC theater school knew John Blankenship. He brought the first ever international group to Edinburgh in 1966, and they fired him a couple times. He still showed up to class. Like he just was like, what am I going to do, stay home? So this guy was amazing and such a mentor to me. And he called me and said, I need you to come to Edinburgh and Paris. I'm going to fly you there. I'm going to put you up. You're going to direct a show. You're going to act in a few other shows. You're going to be there 3 weeks. You're going to have 1 week off. After that week, you're going to come to Edinburgh. You're going to be in 6 more shows. You're going to direct. I'm taking care of you. Please say yes. What's the week off, John? The week off was exactly when my friends were getting married in France. I was like, that's an amazing sign. So I follow this amazing thing. I give my notice. I go. I spend the entire summer doing theater. I'm on 850-seat theater at the Pierre Cardin in the middle of Paris. And by the way, my mom had passed a couple years earlier. And this is my first time back to Paris since then. And I look out the window of the theater and there's the tree we took a photograph in front of on the Champs-Élysées. And I couldn't help but feel like she was shining down on me and being like, you're in the right place. Here's a sign, right? Here's an omen. And so this is this amazing time. I go to Edinburgh. My best friends come with me. I get them. I cast them. Like, we have this amazing epic trip. And then I have to come back to the States. And I'm like, I'm not taking a job out of fear. I'm not taking a day job that's soul sucking. I got to figure something else out. So I didn't care. I was open. I was like, maybe I'll get a job at a 5-star hotel and see what that life is like. Maybe I'll work for a production company. Who knows? I was open to anything. But I came back. And 1 week after I came back, 9/11 happened. And 9/11 obviously shook the world. But there were no auditions. There were no jobs. I couldn't get a job catering. I couldn't get a job temping. I couldn't get a job doing anything I'd done before. So the only thing I could do was offer help. I offered one session of life coaching and one session of feng shui. And that started a word of mouth business that I've had to this day. 3 years later, I got business cards. 5 years later, I got a website. 6 years later, I had a radio show. 7 years, 8 years later, like, I'm flying back and forth across the country. I'm Skyping people. Like, and it eventually led me to first do feng shui for Dr. Oz's production company and meet people there and work on his house. And then I was invited to be a guest on the show. And it was, to my knowledge, maybe one of the first times feng shui has ever been spoken about on that kind of platform, you know. And boy, that was a little bit of pressure and excitement and all of it at once.
And you're acting at the same time.
Yeah. So
living the Joe life, as well as the aerial life as the feng shui guru?
Yeah, so, you know, I moved out here from New York in 99. And I think from 99 to 2006, my career was building. Like, new reps, more people on the team, co-stars turn into guest stars turn into films. I went through dry spells. I went through periods where it was really hard. I was a tall guy who had a baby face. So I was in between two different stages of life, and that was a little bit challenging. And I didn't audition for commercials back then. But I was working more and more, and I felt like the feng shui was helping. And then a huge sort of life moment happened. And I got a phone call that my dad had been hospitalized. And I left. This was July 25th, 2006. I got on a plane, and I went, I didn't know for what, to say goodbye, to show up and see what was needed. And because I had lost my mom, you know, when I was 21, I was like, part of me was like, here I go again. And another part of me was like, well, let's see. And it was really emotional. And, you know, my relationship with my dad wasn't perfect, and it was fraught with challenges, but it was the most amazing healing experience for both of us. I mean, this man was on a breathing tube. He had his intestine had like atrophied, and like a foot and a half of it stopped working. And he had his gallbladder removed, and he gained 50 pounds of water. And if you saw him, you're like, this guy is not long for this world. And I watched him, and I stayed with him, and I watched him, and I prayed for him, and I watched him, and I stayed with him. And his breathing tube came out after 4 or 5 weeks. And the first thing he said to me was, you're a comfort to me. He barely got it out, but boy, never had I heard any words from him in my entire life that meant more than those few words. And then I heard him say, I want to stay. I want to be here. I want to fight through this, and I want to make it. And that determination was extraordinary, to watch him go through potential surgeries. Like, they got really worried they're going to have to go through another major surgery. And they're like, unless his capillaries in his intestine regrow miraculously, we're going to have to resect his intestine, a foot and a half of it. And that's really dangerous given what he went through. They did a test like the night before the surgery, and they said his intestine's working. So like miracle after miracle, and he got out, and they're like, he's never going to walk uphill again. He may not make it through the next year. Well, he moved to Florida, changed his life, de-stressed, started walking by the ocean. Here we are 10 years later. He moved himself to Laguna Beach. He's a DJ on the radio. He's reclaimed what he wants to do with his life. And my life and him in it is better for it. Like, our relationship, that was the reason for that time. Now, I come back from that time in New York. I've been gone for months. And my manager drops me, and my career is at a halt. So from beginning of 2007, until now, it has been a process of rebuilding, because in this town, momentum is very fleeting and doesn't last for long. And it takes a long time to get it going. And I just saw what happens if you let it go. And so I got into commercials and I started booking those, and I started to make my living as an actor. And, you know, feng shui is always like this symbiotic relationship where it's like, what am I doing today? Am I going to help people? Or am I going to perform? And at the beginning, I kind of felt like it was a selfish thing. Like, I got to be a performer. I got to not go to dinner. I got to focus on me and be selfish. And I didn't see the generosity of spirit that comes with performing one line, one scene, one something that might touch someone. You know, you've experienced this with documentary, letters you're getting from all around the world. And, you know, again, Warner Laughlin, you know, it's who I met when I came back, and I was like, I got to get into class. And she helped me get my confidence back, and she helped me have a repeatable process that felt creative and fulfilling. And, you know, I've been really fortunate. I've traveled to Pakistan and been in movies there and met people from other cultures and gotten to be on TV shows doing wacky comedies. And I just love it, man. I just love what I get to do. And I'm so grateful to be able to almost like learn and pay it forward as I'm learning myself and experiencing it, because I might be just one step further ahead on the same path. But I feel like if any of us are going to make it, we got to have one step, one hand forward and one hand back.
Well, like, I mean, the image that's in my mind is like the infinity symbol. Like, you got this almost like one side is like, call it green, and the other side is blue or whatever. And
go Hawks.
One is, yeah, go Hawks. Exactly. You know, one is you acting, one is you giving via feng shui. And
yeah.
You know, I want to ask you a question that I can't even take the credit for. A longtime listener, Lindsay, we were talking, we were preparing for this, and I'm like, what would you ask Joe? And this is a really cool question. If you look at epic performers, right, you've got Beyonce. She's got this other side to her, right? Whatever it's called, like Sasha Fierce or something like that, right? You got Kobe. You got Black Mamba.
Right.
Right. You got Russell Wilson. He doesn't have a name yet, but he talks about when he gets on the field, he's a different guy. He's not the same guy that's every Tuesday in the children's hospital in Seattle, right? I feel the same way when I'm performing. Have you ever looked at yourself like that? You've got this, you know, Black Mamba to you, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, so...
And you literally have two names. You know?
I know. Well, I'm so glad you said that, because I was going to say, bringing it full circle to your first question, it has everything to do with those names. So... when I first started getting into feng shui, I started to become a different auditioner and a different actor. And I'd go into meetings and casting meetings and I'd be like, so how are you? And I started asking them questions about their office. And I was like, so not in my like masculine and like the guy you'd want to have a beer with. I was like in my feminine, really supportive. And how are you? And that's not interesting. Like, that's not what your job is. And it's not what they want. And part of that was hiding. I would go to parties and people would be like, so what have they seen you in? And I would, and it was Keanu Reeves really there. And I was like, I don't want to answer this question because there's so much energy behind it that makes me want to sort of take a breath and maybe vomit a little bit in my mouth. And, you know, so I started talking about feng shui as an avoidance of talking about acting. And so it was a mistake, but I started bringing that in the room. So around that time, I had made peace with Ariel and I merged my names together. And so I'm Ariel Joseph Town. So now my manager's like, well, they keep saying they can't get an appointment for Ms. Town. So firstly, they didn't even look at my picture and they weren't able to tell that I was a male. And then secondly, there were people that were now from USC, filmmakers, casting people, like, who's Eric? Do you mean Joe Town? Yeah, he can come in and audition. So I had to make a purposeful decision, which was Joe Town is my acting name. It's my artist name. And Ariel is the guy that comes in and feng shui is your life. And so purposely making that split was really important back then. Like, I knew my personality. I knew what shoes to slip into, you know? So yeah, I get that. Like, there's a different vibe when you're on set. And it doesn't mean... And so all that to be said, in the last year, I've realized I need to merge these two personalities together. I need to become one Joe, my friends have jokingly said. That's why I got a hat for my birthday. It says one Joe on it. Because I got to merge these two sides together. There's this split from the two households, you know, going to one side of the family, going to the other side of the family, being Ariel, being Joe, being one way in school, being another way with friends, you know, like at a certain point, that's just exhausting. And so I still understand the idea of like infusing yourself into a character and then breathing it out. That's always going to remain as my performer self. But in terms of me walking around the world, I gotta be through one filter for a while.
Well, that's the beautiful thing. And I never knew Ariel and I never knew Joe. To me, I've known the whole you.
Right.
You know, we've been hanging for a couple years.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that's really impactful, and I want you to, you know, touch upon this. Of, we have a lot of listeners out there, and all of us, whether you're right wing, left wing, you're voting for Hillary, you're voting for the other guy,
the orange clown.
Right.
Sorry, some of your listeners probably. It's okay. I like this guy. He speaks his mind. Okay, go ahead.
But we all are seeking our path, our purpose, and there becomes a point in time. And unfortunately, I found that I think it's after loss, it's after a difficult time, it's after you hit rock bottom, where you're like, this is me, man. You know, whether it's a breakup, whether it's a job, whether somebody passes away. And that, thankfully, hasn't happened to you. So what's your advice to people that they know that they need to make this switch? They know that they want to live their true self, right? Like, your example is the greatest, especially in Los Angeles. Hi, how are you? What's your name? Hi, I'm, for instance, Yogi. So what do you do out here? I'm an actor. Really? Oh, you're like everybody else, right? So what are you waiting on? Like, what table are you waiting on? I mean, that, I've heard that conversation before. And that's screwed up.
Yeah.
So what's your advice to people that are in the midst of that struggle and they even have not even verbalized it yet, or are literally living these, you know, all right, I'm a cold call sales guy during the day and I go to acting class at night, but I'm totally confused because I only get a few opportunities in a room, whether that room is a dating room or a business room, and I don't know who I am.
Yeah. It's such a good question. I mean, I think I've maybe explored a lot of different tactics. I think as far as feng shui and intentionality goes, this is actually an acting principle too, which is act as if you are the thing you seek, right? Be the change you want to see in your world. And so if you're seeking being an actor, instead of saying like, I'm approaching being an actor, just say I'm an actor and like, see what happens with living with that. And if you have some head noise as a result of it, okay, like tackle that next. But be the thing you wish to experience. And so sometimes it takes putting the cart a little bit before the horse, I've found. And that helps the process a little bit. And for other people, it's like, no, I want a poll take. I want everybody else's opinion that I am an actor. And then I'll whisper to the world that I'm an actor. And that's okay. Like, whatever your path is. And, you know, this is my advice, but don't, you know, do you. But I think that there's also something to be said for like playful mischief. I do certain things to help me get through auditions. I do certain things to help me get through party situations. Sometimes I make stuff up. and it's the way that I can be creative and avoid the energy of questions that infuriate me or frustrate me. And so I remember there was this time that I was going to see this band. And it was an amazing band. Dan Finnerty and the Dan Band. If you've never seen Old School, it's the band that's like singing and swearing and the whole thing. And Dan's an amazing performer. And he and his wife, Kathy and Jimmy, used to host all these different people at Largo back when it was on La Cienega, Fairfax, before it moved to La Cienega. And I remember, you know, there'd be all these celebrities there. And this is me being out here 2 years. I'm still awestruck. I'm still seeing John Travolta and Kelly Preston and Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston and, you know, like all these people in the room. And I'm sitting there going, oh my God, I'm in the room with these people. And I never wanted to like go up and like get their, I didn't want to take anything from them if I didn't have anything to offer. So if like I bumped into them, I'd say hi and not be a jerk, but I just was happy to be there. And I remember going to one of the shows and sitting in the back of the room and I just said hi to the woman next to me. She was a sweet woman. She was in her 70s. I was like, what are you doing here? You having a good time? And it turns out she's Dan's mom. And Dan's mom and I had the most epic conversation for 35 minutes. And we were talking about upstate New York, where I was born. We were talking about life. We were talking about Dan. We were talking about the world. I had the best time because we were talking about real stuff. And Dan comes over and he goes, I see you met my mom. And he said, hey, if you ever want to come see a show, let me know. I'll put you on the list. So I didn't seek that. It just happened. And I feel like whenever I've just been real and shown up and finally taken the advice that my acting teachers tried to give me back when I was in college and before, just be you, because I had Ariel and because I had Joe and because I was an actor, I was like, there's so many me's inside. I don't know what you mean. But when I'm just me and I'm doing me and a little bit of playful and a little bit of mischief, like good stuff happens. Those signs show up and then I know I'm where I'm supposed to be.
So Ariel Joseph Town, how would you describe yourself?
Very tall. Very tall. I love guacamole.
You got your treasure
bio. Well, I do a few different things, right? I'm really passionate about storytelling. And it doesn't really matter to me how. If I'm helping somebody tell their story and coaching them up, if I'm writing or if I'm performing. I love storytelling. And I also love helping. You know, there's this whole thing. Helping people get to where they want to go. And I think that that's expressed itself in a lot of different ways. You know, my wife jokes that I should be a production executive because when I'm helping her with a script, she goes, "You're really good at helping me clarify my story." I love approaching that. I don't think it's any different from when I was a personal assistant back in the day, or when I was an executive assistant at a, you know, a firm in New York that did management consulting. Like, it's all the same thing. I'm trying to help. I'm trying to tell great stories. And the stories all seem to have to do with fighting the good fight. You know, the light over the darkness, like all the different like epic stories that are told. That's what I'm into. You know, I'm into people's stories and celebrating them.
Yeah. Oh, I couldn't agree more. I mean, just in knowing you in our brief history in terms of a long life, you've always been that. You've been the gracious friend. You've been the gracious host, and you've been gracious on this podcast. And I'm really jacked because we've explored you in your youth as a performer. We've shared how you got into feng shui, the art of it. We've gotten to how you blended it, and we're going to hit pause and we're literally going to shway my place, my apartment. And we're going to come back and there's gonna be a part two of this podcast. So I still have some more questions we're going to dive into, but cool. I want to go through this process and, share maybe what happens. Cause I don't know if we're going to be like, we building a campfire. I have really no idea what's happening right now. Like, is, you know, Yanni's going to roll up here and all of a sudden
he might.
But I'm really excited. And I think my takeaway from part one of this conversation is that we are all on this path to figure out us. Mm-hmm. And whether I deal with quarterbacks who identify as quarterbacks, I think when they go through the journey, and if you asked Drew Brees or Tom Brady, these guys that have been around for a long time, or actors, just like you have shared your story, and performers and successful people, they are what their soul gets fed. Mm-hmm. They are where they lean in most passionately, and I think it's an awesome gift for the listeners, I think.
Sweet, man. Well, I'm so excited for what's about to happen. Let's do this, brother.
All right. Yeah. All right. Well, this is the Life Without Limits podcast, part one with Mr. Ariel Joseph Town. We're going to go shway it up, and I'm going to take the advice that we give at the end of every episode that Joe thankfully helped me cultivate. The only limits we have in life are the ones we set ourselves. In my apartment, I'm going to say it right now. We're wide open, Joe. Whatever you want to do, we're going for it.
All right.
All right.